Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. This hour on the program, we'll find out more about women's health and women's rights around the world. There are still great obstacles to social justice for women worldwide. For example, more than 500,000 women die each year as a result of pregnancy or childbirth. Many of those deaths could be prevented. Women and girls are disproportionately infected with HIV/AIDS. Some international HIV prevention programs don't focus on women and girls, and they could. And in many countries, women don't have basic legal rights like the right to own property or inherit it. Also, women and young girls are exploited in the international sex trade. We'll find out more about all of this. My guest this hour, Adrienne Germain, is president of the International Women's Health Coalition. It's a nonprofit organization whose mission is to promote and protect the health and rights of women and girls around the world. She says there are many more things that the international community could do to ensure women's fundamental rights and that the United States can make a critical difference for women and girls around the world. We'll find out more. Welcome to Columbus, Adrienne Germain. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
My guest will be speaking, by the way, today, 11:30 this morning, for a luncheon and speech at the Columbus Council on World Affairs down at the Athletic Club, 136 East Broad. For information, you can call the Columbus Council at 229-4599 if you'd like to attend, 229-4599. Now, it's amazing to me that more than 500,000 women die each year, according to your figures, as a result of pregnancy or childbirth? And what are we failing to do here?
Well, it's actually, these are not our figures, but rather the figures of the World Health Organization. And what we're failing to do is to make simple, basic investments in health services close to where women live. Saving women's lives in childbirth is not rocket science. Mm-hmm. It requires that there be a midwife, someone trained to help a woman in normal childbirth, recognize when she's having complications during labor, and be able to refer her or take her quickly to a local health facility that can help her when there's a serious complication that might require a blood transfusion or a cesarean section. This is not expensive. We've known how to do this for all of the 40 years that I have been working on behalf of women and girls in poor countries. Basically, we have simply lacked the political will to allocate the money and to bring services close to where people live.
Adrienne, when you say we have lacked the political will, who's we?
We, in the broad sense, is both the national governments in poor countries who don't often hear from their women. Women are very often voiceless in political terms in these countries and in social terms. But we also includes the United States government in its foreign assistance programs, and frankly, the governments of Japan, Canada, and Europe, Australia, who contribute money to poor countries to build up their health care.
Mm-hmm. But somehow these women, when we contribute money to build up their health care, all of the United States and our allies, these women, the basic services are neglected. But why?
Well, for two, almost three decades of my work, the most important priority that all of these donor governments had, and that they insisted governments of Asia, Africa, and Latin America pay attention to, was population control. Mm-hmm. So they invested in family planning services, which are very important for women. And if it had not been for that investment, many women would not have had the opportunity to use contraception. However, all of these women live in societies where they are expected to marry and to have children. So at some point, all of these women want to have babies, and they need help when they're pregnant and when they're giving birth. But we in the rich countries simply didn't make that possible. We didn't invest in training the midwives. We didn't invest in providing for emergency obstetric care mm-hmm. down at the local health facility. We did invest in some high-level hospitals. We have invested in major diseases. We have in like TB and malaria. We have invested in what's called child survival. But when it comes to caring for women, what's called maternal health, mm-hmm. women as mothers, we've done very poorly.
You cite some countries where there have been some success stories with regard to this. Bangladesh, you say, also Thailand, mm-hmm. Egypt, Honduras. What have they done that the other countries have not done?
They've done the simple things that I mentioned. Bangladesh is one where I was most recently and most intimately involved. There, that was a country which had the kind of top-down investment in family planning services for many years that I described. So they already had a good foundation such that women who didn't want to be pregnant at a certain time could contracept. Furthermore, Bangladesh was farsighted in recognizing that contraception is not perfect. So they also had allowed for early safe abortion services. And we had worked with the government there for some time to ensure that women who became pregnant and didn't want to be could safely end those pregnancies. But otherwise, women were not given any help at all in giving birth. 98% of women in Bangladesh gave birth at home with no assistance in the most deplorable conditions. So what we did in the mid-1990s was to work with the government and with the donors, including the United States, but also several Europeans, and also with civil society, with women themselves, to develop a new plan that would continue the family planning services, but also recognize that every woman in Bangladesh marries and has to have children. Mm-hmm. And so we would help them get through the birth process safely. And what we did was we took really a very limited human resource pool, because Bangladesh doesn't have a lot of health workers. We took a very limited envelope of money, and we said, okay, how can we spend this in the most effective way? And what we did was to train young women who actually had only high school education to be good midwives, and then we trained local level health centers to provide basic obstetric care. And in 5 years, the maternal death rate, that is death during childbirth, came down by 25% for the first time.
How long does it take to train a woman to become a midwife?
Well, in Bangladesh, because the birth rate was high and you have many, many clients, you have lots of women who are giving birth, it only took 18 months. Because to become a midwife, you have to practice.
Sure.
You know, you need to have women who are having babies. Now, in some other countries where the population isn't so dense, where women are living in much more scattered villages and so on, we have to think of a bit more creative ways of doing the training. Because although in most other countries more women are coming to hospital to give birth to babies, we still will have more challenges to train those midwives. But we can do it. We're doing it in Ethiopia. We're doing it even in Niger, two of the poorest countries on the face of the earth. So the problem is that we're not devoting enough resources to it. Instead, what we've done is to focus on specific diseases, like HIV, AIDS, TB, or malaria. We're not building up the basic health service capacity. We're just focusing on disease control.
My guest, Adrienne Germain, is president of the International Women's Health Coalition. It's a nonprofit organization. Their mission, to promote and protect the health and rights of women and girls worldwide. We're at 614-292-8513. If you'd like to talk about the issue with us this morning. Adrienne, also, you bring up the idea of HIV/AIDS, and you say that in many countries, women are disproportionately infected with this virus. And interesting story behind that. Why is that so?
Well, the countries where more women than men are infected are primarily in sub-Saharan Africa, and parts of the Caribbean, which are also the countries that have the highest levels of infection in the entire population. And in these countries, you have, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, out of all the people living with HIV, more than 60% are female. And among the young people who are ages 15 to 24 living with HIV, 76% are female. Now, people might immediately think, well, does that mean that all these young women and girls are running around and promiscuous? No, it doesn't mean that.
Is it the men are? Is that the idea?
Well, yes, they are, actually. And the reason that women and girls are so disproportionately infected is that in much of sub-Saharan Africa, girls are married very young to older men who already have sexual experience and who are likely these days to be infected, and they bring HIV into their marriage with the young girl. Mm-hmm. Most sexually active adolescents, teenage women in Africa are married. They're not single. So that's the first point. Second point is that in some countries with the highest prevalence, and those are the southern and eastern Africa countries, Botswana, South Africa, Namibia, Swaziland, that whole belt, you also have a phenomenon which is called concurrent partners. Well, what is that? People in those countries, often the men more than the women, but some women also, have more than one sexual partner at the same time. They may have a polygamous arrangement, that is, a man has more than one wife, or a man may have a wife and a mistress, or informally a man may have a wife in the village and then, quote, a wife in the city where he is working. This pattern doesn't mean that the people in Africa have more partners than we do in the United States. Not at all. It's just in the United States we tend to have the same number of partners, but we have them one at a time. We have serial partnerships. Mm-hmm. Whereas the people in the eastern and southern part of Africa are having them at the same time. And in epidemiological terms, that's like having a stick of dynamite in a glass full of HIV, in a glass full of virus. It explodes the virus. It just moves it through the population like a wildfire. So you get an intensity of spread that you don't have otherwise. It's sort of a complicated, concept. But that pattern of sexual relationships is critically important. And it is driven primarily by men's sexual behavior. At the same time, in these communities, and this is true in the Caribbean as well, the levels of sexual coercion and violence by men against girls and young women are disastrously high. And it's not just in those violent sexual acts that HIV is transmitted. Violence against women has broader consequences. It means that in any sexual relationship, and certainly in marriage, the girl or the woman doesn't have the power to challenge her partner if she thinks he's having relations with somebody else. She doesn't have the power to ask him to use a condom. More often than not, she'll get beaten up or thrown out or divorced or blamed herself.
If
she challenges him and says, look, I know you're sleeping around, so please use a condom with me. He's likely, and study after study shows this, he's likely to beat her up or accuse her of sleeping around, when in fact, that's not what's happening.
So this is a very complicated situation, because in the countries we're talking about here that have those kinds of cultural norms, I mean, for men and women, you've got to change the whole culture here.
Yes. But, these norms in some form are just as true in the United States. And changing a whole culture is something that we need to do, and that is why the International Women's Health Coalition is working both with governments and international agencies and with civil society organizations in Asia, Africa, and Latin America to promote programs and actually work with young people so that they grow up in a different way and they learn at a very early age to treat each other differently.
For example, give me an idea of a program that might do that. How would that work? Mm-hmm.
Well, there's so many different ones I could describe for you. In Calabar, Nigeria, for example, which is a southeastern state where they mine all of the oil and where there's a lot of poverty, and where in Nigeria that's the highest level of HIV infection, 12% in that case. There are programs that we support for young girls beginning at the age of 8, but going also up to age 18. Those programs are teaching young girls through participation, through role play, through work outside of school and work in school, to build their own self-esteem, their sense of confidence. They learn to speak in public, to lead group processes and so on, at the same time that they are learning all about sex and sexuality, about their bodies, about menstruation, about pregnancy, about contraception, about HIV, AIDS. So they're getting all kinds of information that they will never be given by their family. Sex is a taboo subject. Like many girls that otherwise would go into marriage with no knowledge whatsoever.
Is it okay with their families that you're giving them all this information?
Yes. These kinds of programs are always worked out in consultation with school principals and teachers, religious leaders, parent associations, and so on. Otherwise, they would fail. But basically, these young girls learn what risky situations are, and there are many, which I could share with you. At the same time, they learn that they don't have to give sex to their teachers when their teachers demand it in order to give them a grade that they actually earned in school.
That's commonplace?
That's very commonplace. They learn that when a man accosts them in the market and they're selling oranges and says, you know, come to my house and then I'll pay you, they learn that that's dangerous and they should say no. They you know, all of those kind of skills building activities are included. But right down the block, and actually managed by the husband of one of the founders of this program, is a program for boys.
I was about to ask.
And in this case, they decided the boys and girls programs would be separate. In other cases, the boys and girls are together, so they can vary. But with the boys, it's a matter of learning, really, that they don't have a right to beat up their future wives the way their fathers beat their mothers. That they should be sharing household responsibilities, not relying on their sisters the way they do at home. Boys in Nigeria, just like boys in India and around the world, are raised to think that their sisters are there to serve them, and that's the way they treat their future wives. They learn about female genital mutilation, and I've been in these programs when they actually learn what female genital mutilation is. And when they learn actually what it is, they're horrified. And that's a way to end this practice. So we firmly believe that raising young people today differently is as important in Nigeria as it is in the United States, and that the current U.S. government promotion of abstinence only until marriage education, which is a moralistic, ideologically driven, narrow process that young people are exposed to, will really get us nowhere. And science proves that it doesn't protect young people from the risk of unwanted pregnancy or HIV/AIDS.
We have some data on this now for abstinence-only programs and their effectiveness or lack of effectiveness.
We do.
And tell me about that.
Well, we have studies actually coming mostly from the United States that have been reviewed by the Institute of Medicine and actually the National Academy of Sciences, clearly showing that in all the programs reviewed, the abstinence-only work in this country does not delay age at sexual debut, as it's called, that is the age at which young people start having sex. And what is also clear from these programs is that when kids who've been in that kind of program do start having sex, which they do, they are much less likely to use safe sex behaviors, including condoms.
Much less likely.
Much
less
likely.
If they've been
likely.
In an abstinence program.
That's correct.
Why do you think that would be?
Because they're not told anything about condoms, and they haven't developed the skills to negotiate condom use. Then overseas, again, the General Accounting Office and the IOM, the Institute of Medicine, has evaluated our global AIDS program and clearly concluded that the promotion of abstinence-only until marriage programming in the U.S. government's global AIDS work has been not only ineffective, but counterproductive and negative. And still, we have been funding these programs overseas. Despite the concern by many of the national AIDS programs in those countries that this is not what they want and it's not what their young people need.
Hmm. Back to Nigeria for just a second. When you have the young boys in one group and the young girls being educated, I wonder how long a process that is. And when you tell the young boys, look, you don't want to do what your fathers did, which is to hit your mother anytime you felt like it. That's not your right to do that. And you tell the young girls, look, you don't have to put up with this kind of behavior. How long does this take to really change attitudes? Because I imagine if a young boy has seen his father and his grandfather hitting their wives, thinks of his sisters as people who wait on him, how long is it going to take to change that mentality?
Well, you know, I think clearly it's going to change only across generations. But my work on this started 40 years ago. And shortly after I began, we had the first World Women's Conference by the UN in Mexico City in 1975. These ideas and premises were agreed by governments at that time, including the U.S. government, mm-hmm. I may say. And if we had done from then what we agreed to do at that time, we would have had already at least two, maybe depending on how you count, three generations of young people raised according to these norms and these values.
What did we agree to do in 1975 in Mexico City that we didn't do? I mean, collectively, the world governments then failed to do it. What is mm-hmm. that?
They're very simple things. We agreed that girls and boys equally should have access to school. We agreed that women equally need access to the means to earn a living, so credit, employment, training, and job skills. We agreed that women who alone bear the burden as well as the joy of pregnancy and childbirth should have health services to meet those needs and to treat sexually transmitted diseases. We agreed on just the basics of what people in the United States take for granted and assume. We agreed that women should have equal representation politically. We agreed that women should be at every policy table making major decisions in their countries. This is not rocket science, mm-mm. none of it. It all has to do with the power of men over women, including in the public sphere as well as in the family.
So men didn't want to relinquish this power, is that the idea?
No, they didn't. And so there's some great men, however, who have been working with women all these years. But one of the consequences of our failure, our global failure, to move toward those very early agreements, which were absolutely path-breaking in Mexico City. I mean, those of us who were there will never forget it. Is in fact HIV/AIDS, which itself is a terrible disease. But what it is for women is simply a symptom, a revealing to the world of how badly we treat women. Mm. Because for the most part, women are not transmitting this disease. It's not women's behavior that's driving the HIV pandemic in almost any country or any community. It's what men are doing, and women are vulnerable to it because of what men do to them.
My guest this hour, Adrienne Germain, is president of the International Women's Health Coalition. They're a nonprofit organization. Their mission to promote and protect the health and rights of women and girls worldwide. My guest speaks today at a luncheon at 11:30 this morning at the Columbus Council on World Affairs at the Columbus Athletic Club, 136 East Broad, and her topic, A New Agenda for Girls and Women's Health and Rights. For information, call the Columbus Council on World Affairs if you'd like to attend. Their number is 614-229-4599. That's 614-229-4599. After this break, we'll be right back with my guest and you callers at WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how digital media, including MP3 players and music websites, are changing how people discover, listen to, and share music, and what that's doing to the music industry. We talk with Elliot Van Buskirk. He covers digital media for Wired.com on his blog, Listening Post. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air will be here later this afternoon, beginning at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It's 45 degrees at 10:31. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. You can listen to Open Line with Fred Anderle where you want and when you want with the Open Line podcast. Search Open Line at the iTunes Music Store to download each program to your iPod or MP3 device. Please join WOSU on the weekends for Bob Edwards Weekend. It's a two-hour interview program that celebrates host Bob Edwards and highlights the life and work of interesting people, from newsmakers, historians, and authors, to artists, actors, and regular folks, too. Listen to Bob Edwards Weekend, Saturday afternoons at 2, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. In the forecast for today, partly sunny skies with a slight chance of rain, a high of 58 today. For tonight, clouds begin to move in overnight, a low of 42. And for Friday, cloudy with morning showers and a high of 52 on Friday. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. Again, we're talking about women's health, women's rights around the world. You found out in the first half hour more than 500,000 women die each year as a result of pregnancy or childbirth, and many of those deaths we find out could be prevented. Again, women and girls disproportionately infected in many countries with HIV/AIDS. Again, steps could be taken to change that and are being taken to change that. Women don't have basic legal rights often, like the right to own property or inherit it. My guest, Adrienne Germain, is president of the International Women's Health Coalition, and she's with us here in Columbus. We're at 614-292-8513. So all these at the International Conference for Women in 1975 in Mexico City, all of these agreements were made among governments around the world, but the follow-through was lacking. And then was it in 1980 in Beijing there was another international conference?
Actually, it was 1995, 20 years later. But between that, those, there were two others. Mm-hmm. So we had lots of conference time, shall we say, about women. And each time we... One of the points of these conferences is to get governments to make commitments to act. And some people think that's a waste of time. We didn't think it was a waste of time because very often in these international meetings, women can actually negotiate with their governments in a UN setting, and they can't even get access to their governments when they're at home. Mm-hmm. And then furthermore, when a government agrees to a UN document or declaration, they can be held accountable for it. And most of the governments that we're most concerned about in Asia, Africa, and Latin America actually have ratified treaties and are subject to monitoring and reporting to the UN system. So our friends from these countries go home from a UN conference and then go back to their governments and say, okay, you agreed to this. So what are you going to do? And furthermore, when they are called on to report to the UN, the civil society organizations can say to them, you've done a very poor job, and we ourselves are going to tell the UN that. And they do.
Mm-hmm. In terms of women's rights, where have we made, as a result of all those many agreements, where have we made real progress?
The most progress has been in the area of education. We've come a long way to close the gap between boys and girls, especially in primary school. And in certain countries and regions, the gap in secondary high school is closing. However, the quality of education is really, really lagging behind. And part of the quality also has a male-female edge to it. The studies have shown, and there's a major National Academy of Sciences review that has documented this, that gender or sex discrimination in the classroom is rampant across countries, so that boys are treated very differently by teachers than girls are in all the stereotypical ways, for instance. Second is that sexual harassment by students, boy students against girls, and by teachers, men teachers against girls, as well as sexual violence in schools and by against girls as they walk often or travel to school and from school is rampant. I could give you many examples from programs that we support in countries as different as Pakistan and Cameroon.
For example, yeah, give me a couple of examples.
Well, for example, in Pakistan, which as many people probably know is a rather conservative Muslim society for the most part, girls are really not supposed to go outside their homes without a man accompanying them. It's not like Saudi Arabia, which is very, very rigid, but women are really only safe in Pakistan if they're going to move around, if they are accompanied by a male relative. And so when girls need to go back and forth to school, and especially from lower-income families, if they don't have a car and so on, they need to take a bus or they need to walk. And if you don't have a brother to walk you to school, or your brother's in a different school, and you really want to go to school, you're in a big problem. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is what's called Eve teasing, as in Adam and Eve teasing, which is a very gentle term for really vicious sexual harassment on the streets. In Pakistan, India, you see it a lot. And
if a woman walks alone to school?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that can be very discouraging for the girl. It can also turn violent, just like that, very quickly. So programs that we support, again, in Pakistan, work with young people in schools, boys and girls together, with the teachers, with the principals, to try to help young people in the communities talk this through and help boys realize they don't have a right to accost girls like that. And one session I had was with boys and girls. The girls had developed enough courage in this setting to actually say to the boys, well, what if, you know, a boy treated your sister like that? Do you think that would be right? And the boys actually said, well, yes, of course, if she's out by herself, then she... And the girl... That was a breakthrough point for the girls. They really just let the boys have it. And, you know, in a setting like Pakistan, girls would normally never let boys have it, so to speak. Mm. So it was a very important moment because this was in a classroom where the boys and girls were seated separately on different sides of the room, where the girls were veiled, where the teacher was veiled, where we were in a very conservative religious community. So they were working through this problem in a way that was very respectful of the community from which these young people came. But at the same time, they were saying, we are human beings. Nobody has a right to harass a girl just because she's walking to school, properly dressed, properly veiled.
Did the boys in this particular classroom wind up agreeing with that premise, or did they really resist it?
Not by the end of this session.
They did not agree?
No.
They still thought if their sister walked to school alone, she deserved any harassment she got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you can see how much work is needed.
When you say that kind of harassment in Pakistan could turn violent, I mean, how violent? Would a woman be beaten up, or what would happen to her?
Beaten, raped. And then in some communities, as you've probably seen in the news, if that happens, it's her fault. She will be disowned. Mm-hmm. If she's in a certain kind of family, a male relative may kill her for what is called an honor violation. That is to say that she's brought shame on the family for having been, quote unquote, violated. Such a man is identified and taken to court. The court will excuse him because it's done on behalf of the family's honor. Now, this is something that has gone on for generations. These kind of actions are violations of the fundamental rights of women to life and integrity of the person. Pakistan has signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They have to do that in order to be a member of the United Nations. Nobody has a right to murder a woman for any reason, let alone a reason as trivial as this. And so a lot of the work that we support and that others are supporting is for local organizations in countries such as Pakistan to recognize this as a basic human rights violation. But part of our uphill challenge is that many of the standard conventional human rights groups don't see this as a human rights violation.
They don't see being murdered for walking to school as a human rights violation.
No, they see it as a sociocultural practice.
Murder.
They don't see it as murder. They see it as an honor killing. So
these are the local human rights organizations.
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, it's only in recent years, because, you know, I have a long history myself, but it's only in recent years, as short as the last decade, that some of the international human rights organizations have recognized this kind of issue as a matter of concern that they should take up. Because women's rights haven't been recognized as human rights. And in fact, Hillary Clinton had to say it in those stark terms in Beijing in 1995.
You give Pakistan as an example of how a woman might be treated. Is Pakistan unusual, or do you find that kind of treatment in lots of countries around the world?
Well, honor killings of that sort, or harassment of students that I described. Well, honor killings and extreme violations of that sort happen in a lot of countries across the Middle East, North Africa, South Asia. Harassment of the kind that I described is virtually universal. It happens in every country in various forms. It took years of effort by many of us to get the World Health Organization to conduct a study of violence against women and then raise the money to do it. And it was a multi-country study. I think there were 20 countries involved, maybe not even that many. That has revealed that on average, one out of every three women in the world in her lifetime will be subjected to violence, I mean, not just harassment, but violence, mm-hmm. in her lifetime, just because she's a woman. That means here in the United States, it means in Europe, not only Pakistan or Nigeria or Brazil.
My guest, Adrienne Germain, president of the International Women's Health Coalition, joining us here in Columbus, 614-292-8513. Tammy's on the line. Hello, Tammy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that I have such profound respect for the work you're doing and have done for, 40 years? And as a woman in this country and a lifelong feminist, I just can't believe how we still struggle in these areas, even in our own country. And my question pertains to female sexism, which I think is holding women back in every country, especially this one. And my question is, could you speak a little bit to the dynamic of the generational female-to-female oppression culturally? And I'll listen.
When you say, Tammy, could you explain that a little bit? What do you mean by that?
Well, I'll note Phyllis Chesler's books, Woman's Inhumanity to Women. There are cultural dynamics in every culture. Women are raising children. Women are raising males and females, and they have a profound effect on the culture. And I just was wondering, you know, if she could comment on how they do reinforce oppression.
Well, I can't comment really about the situation in the United States with any empirical knowledge, frankly. In other countries, it is often, for example, the mother-in-law who can be the most abusive toward the young bride or the daughter-in-law. It is women raising their sons in a certain sort of way who can reinforce the patterns that I've described here. But, you know, those women were raised also in a certain kind of way.
Yes.
And this is why, and it's not only the mothers who raise children. It is, in the countries that I'm talking about, also not only the fathers. It's a whole cluster of people,
yes.
Often broadening beyond the family into the community. And this is one reason that so many of our friends and program partners where we work, who started by working specifically on rights and health of women, increasingly moved to include in their work young people, both boys and girls,
yeah.
because they became convinced that we must, as much as we want to try to do for women today, we have to raise our children differently. And we can only work with children in these countries anyway by working with and through parents and community leaders. So in actuality, when we say we're working with young people, we're actually engaging the adults in the community as well. I mean, it's just reality. You can't access young people without the adults.
Yeah, I just was wanting you to, I mean, there is a real strong point that, you know, even though you're raised to, you know, oppress other, you know, females and or males, to treat one another a certain way, it doesn't give you an excuse. And I think that sometimes there is our excuses for that behavior in every country, in every culture. And until women themselves quit, you know, victimizing one another, I think that's the real issue. Thank you so much for taking my call, and I'll continue to listen.
Mm-hmm. Tina, thanks for your call, 614-292-8513. So critical to get the young girls and the young boys as well, mm-hmm. in these cultures. Eliot Spitzer, former now, resigned as governor of New York, as we all know, in terms of the recent news headlines about his involvement with a prostitution ring, allegedly. He at one point had gotten a prosecution against a group in Manhattan that was sponsoring sex tours over in Thailand. Now, there was a sexual activity was going on in Thailand that it couldn't be touched, but I guess he got the law changed and managed to do a prosecution against them. Tell me about women in the international sex trade, mm-hmm. and about ages of such women, about exploitation of such women, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, the international sex trade is not, you know, an area of focus of ours. So I can't really give you figures and facts about it. The word trade is very important here because it implies, and to the extent that it actually means, trafficking in women, often against the law, misleading them, telling them they're going for one kind of job, and then in fact basically incarcerating them, forcing
kidnapping them,
enforcing them to have sex to pay off their debts, etc., etc. All of that is very clear human rights violation and has to be stopped.
Mm-hmm. Nicholas Kristof, writing in this morning's New York Times, cites a study by the American Journal of Epidemiology. He says it's a meticulous study finding that workplace homicide rates for prostitutes is 51 times that of the next most dangerous occupation for women. The next most dangerous was working in a liquor store. The average age of death of the prostitutes in the study was 34. So this is a huge difficulty, everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the United States, which again is not my area of expertise, I think I really can't unfortunately comment. But elsewhere in the world, IWHC, my organization, does support organizations of sex workers. And they're mobilizing both among their own community and then also within the communities that in which they work. Part of their mobilizing has to do with making sure that women who come into that work are not being forced and are not underage, i.e. they're not children. Part of their organization has to do with establishing and protecting their rights as laborers, because as you can well imagine, sex work is subject to enormous abuse by corrupt police and judicial systems, by criminals in the community, and so on. This is an issue which is quite challenging, certainly for the women's movement, which has a variety of views about sex work. There, one end of the spectrum feels that any sex work at all is degrading, dehumanizing, dangerous,
inherently,
unacceptable, inherently. Our view about this, which comes from working with organizations of women in sex work in countries like India, is rather reflects the views and concerns and aspirations of the women in sex work that we work with, which is that this is their occupation, their human rights are not being upheld and respected, and furthermore, their effort to make sure that there are no child prostitutes and that women are not trafficked and forced into this work is not recognized. So it's a challenging issue, and I think there are arguments on multiple sides of the issue, but our commitment lies with the reality of women who are in sex work today and whose human rights are being violated in terms of their labor conditions, in terms of their access to health care, which is vital in the situation of HIV/AIDS. And what we do know is that if you criminalize sex work and or if you criminalize the men who go for sex with women in sex work, what happens is you drive it underground and you make it more dangerous for the women. So that's what our concern is.
So there's a split in the women's movement about this.
There is.
Because Nicholas Kristof also cites Melissa Farley. He says she's a psychologist who's written extensively about this subject. She says that girls typically become prostitutes at age 13 or 14. Her study says that 89% of prostitutes urgently want to escape the work, and that two-thirds have post-traumatic stress disorder. So that's at least one viewpoint.
Right. Well, again, I think these studies, as far as I know, are from the United States.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you would find those same results in India, for instance. It remains to be seen. What I do see is that the women that we support and work with are saving their funds, educating their children. Their children don't go into sex work. They're breaking a cycle of poverty, which drove them into the work in the first place.
My guest, Adrienne Germain, president of the International Women's Health Coalition. A few more minutes here. Your call is 614-292-8513. Adrienne, you've got your organization has, and you have an agenda for the new president, whoever he or she may be, right, from the United States. You say the United States can make a critical difference in women's rights around the world. So what's the agenda?
Well, it's a first take on an agenda, and it's focused on the early days, even day one of the new administration. It's got three elements, basically, to protect the human rights of girls and women worldwide, to help guarantee women's access to health services, and to put the power of prevention of HIV into the hands of girls and women. Now, why did we pick these three areas? We chose these three areas because these are the priority agendas of the girls and women that we know and work with and have been working with around the world for 25 years. So that's first and most important, because the U.S. policies and U.S. foreign assistance impact their lives every day in their communities and at the level of their nation's policies. The U.S. has enormous power in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Power for good, but also power for not so good.
Mm-hmm.
In the arena of human rights in these recent years, the U.S. has lost a great deal of standing on the issue of human rights. And I think that we can reclaim our status as a world leader on human rights easily and quickly if we move courageously to support the fundamental human rights of half the world's population, namely girls and women.
So what are some of the specific policies you'd like to see a new president enact and a new Congress enact? If necessary to involve Congress, not in any case.
Yeah. In the initial early days, there are really three things on human rights that the new president can do. He or she can forward to the Senate the major convention on women's rights from the UN. It's called Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW is the name of it. We have not ratified it. We are one of only eight countries that has not ratified it. We joined Somalia and Iran in that honor,
and that's not
a disgrace.
Ratified. Well, what is it about this convention that has led us not to ratify it?
Well, not much, really, except that, this country actually doesn't like ratifying UN treaties. But in the area of women's human rights, this country has a long way to go. In terms of equal representation, in terms of many inequalities between men and women in this country. And it would make a lot of sense if we did ratify it, not only in regard to saying we're going to improve our own record on women's human rights in this country, but also we're going to signal that we are rejoining the UN, recommitting ourselves to work on a basis of what's called multilateralism instead of just going off on our own and doing our own thing without leaving the other governments of the world in the dust. The second thing that we'd like to see the new administration do immediately is to set up a time-limited task force with very clear objectives to review all of the new administration's diplomatic positions and policies, to identify those upcoming opportunities, and there will be a number of them, where the human rights of women can be promoted, whether it's in conflict resolution in areas such as Darfur or immediate crises such as Kenya, the one that's just been solved. A task force like this would again send a signal that the new administration recognizes the enormous disadvantage that girls and women face in the world and the violations of their human rights, which are a matter of daily occurrence.
Just in the final minute, so much of this goes on outside of the general educated public's view. I mean, the convention you've just mentioned, I'll bet most of our audience has never heard of it. I had never heard of it. So much of this goes on in a way that's simply not observed by most voters.
This is true. But I think this new president in today's world should lead a sort of renaissance in the U.S. of commitment to the United Nations. We helped found the United Nations. We held the meetings here, and the United Nations is actually based in this country. We have a globalized world. This institution, the United Nations, is the way that we can work together in a globalized world. And we need vitally to recommit ourselves to it.
Adrienne Germain, president of the International Women's Health Coalition, my guest, speaks for the Columbus Council on World Affairs at 11:30 today at a luncheon at the Columbus Athletic Club. Information from the Columbus Council on World Affairs for tickets at 229-4599. That's 229-4599. Adrienne Germain, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
When we come back at Open Forum at listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Cleveland Museum of Art, presenting Arms and Armor from Imperial Austria, February 24th through June 1st. More information is available at 888-CMA-0033 or at clevelandart.org.